We are joined in the studios once again by none other than Maria Tomczyk, a local writer and activist here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
And no job this week. We are...
He is taking care of his health right now.
That's right. He's back in the hospital, actually.
He's in serious shape, but we're hoping he will be getting better soon.
That's right. We're trying to get him a retread on his vital organs. So
yeah.
The plan is that as soon as he is back on his feet, or even just one of them, we'll wheel him in here and put him in front of a microphone.
He will be contributing again.
That's
soon,
right. Because he'd rather be here than where he is. So.
Yes.
All right. So while you've been gone, a few things have happened.
Yes, they have. But this week, a few things have been happening, too. The city council was working on some legislation this week, getting busy again right before the Easter holiday. They were working on legislation to implement the families and education levy that voters passed last fall. The mayor's office wrote up a plan for implementation of that levy, and the city council then had to review and make changes and pass the plan. The city council added language that would require the city's Department of Education and Early Learning to get council approval for making changes to the implementation plan once it's passed. Durkin's proposal would have given the department almost total freedom to make whatever changes they want. Of course, council oversight is very important for every levy that passes in the city of Seattle, and this one should be no exception. And so the council made that very important change. It also kind of points out the difference between the mayor's philosophy on the council's role and the council's philosophy on its role in city politics. The mayor's philosophy, I guess, is that the council is just a sounding board for people who are discontented in the city and isn't supposed to do much. The city council, on the other hand, takes their job very seriously and understands that they provide important check and balance to the mayor's office and the executive of the city, and that they do have an important oversight role. And so they worked to add that role back into this new plan to implement the families and education levy. Now, the council also added funds for advertising the Promise Program. That's a tuition subsidy program for college in Seattle. They wanted to expand advertising for the program to college students who attend class part-time, not just to full-time students, as the funding in the plan originally was. This brings the program to more students and more in line with students who really need it most. About 43% of all college students in Seattle are enrolled part-time, and most of those students work while they're attending school. So the city council recognized that it was very, very important to make those students aware that they have this money available to help them finish their degrees. Now, the full package of legislation to implement the families and education levy will come up for vote before the full city council on Monday. The city council also passed the library levy with amendments, including additional hours of operations at all 26 branch libraries, and they expanded programs for early childhood learning and for youths. This levy will replace the expiring 2012 library levy, and it will go to voters on the August 6th primary ballot this year.
And isn't that about twice the
It's about twice what the prior levy was. An acknowledgement that we have a bigger population now, and we have more people in need of the use of library facilities, that we need to invest more in building out our branches, in upgrading the ones that we have, and in expanding hours for our libraries.
Yeah, I can still remember when the local libraries got cut way back.
And I do, too.
You know, there was just like, you had to have like 4 days of the week where you could go to your local library.
Yeah, and you had to maybe even take time off work to get there, mm-hmm. or you had to leave work early to get there.
So a lot of people who don't have solid homes, places to stay, libraries are critical for being able to carry out simple daily tasks that we all take for granted.
Simple tasks like checking your email, like mm-hmm. Looking for a job, things like that. Yeah. Paying your bills, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, the City Council's Sustainability and Transportation Committee this week, which is chaired by Mike O'Brien, passed an ordinance to require new buildings in the city to install wiring for electric vehicle charging stations. Buildings don't have to actually install the charging stations. All they have to do is make sure that a certain number of parking spaces have wiring in a nearby wall or in the pavement so that a charging station can easily be installed in the future. That bill will go to the full council for a vote on Monday. The idea behind that bill is that it's a lot cheaper to make sure that that wiring is in there when the building's being built than it is to add it later. That is a very good ordinance, and I hope that that passes on Monday.
Okay, and that's for all types of buildings?
That would be all new buildings.
Okay.
Buildings above a certain size. There probably would not apply to single-family residences, for example. Okay. Although that would be a really good idea for single-family residences. Right. Developers, if you're listening, I doubt that you are.
And like wiring for something like, let's as crazy as solar panels on roofs.
Oh, yeah, because that's expensive to retrofit after the fact, too.
So,
yeah. And considering that buildings are the second largest source of carbon emissions in the state of Washington, the state is definitely moving in the direction of requiring more new buildings to have those kinds of things in place. And so it makes a lot of sense for developers to get on the ball with this and just start providing that kind of amenity, let's call it.
Well, as long as it doesn't eat into profits.
Right. Now, the council's Planning, Land Use, and Zoning Committee, formerly chaired by Rob Johnson, whose last day was, April 5th, and is now chaired by the very hardworking Mike O'Brien, passed a bill out of committee this week to make updates to the city's vacant building monitoring program. The changes include increasing the inspection fee to bring it in line with the city's costs to inspect vacant buildings and strengthening the criteria for enrolling vacant buildings in the inspection program. The goal of the program, of course, is to make sure that landlords keep their properties up to code, but it's also to reduce the number of habitable but vacant buildings in the city to push landlords and building owners to make sure that their buildings stay habited as well as habitable. So that one passed out of the committee and will also eventually go to the full council. City Council member Shama Sawant has also proposed a bill for citywide rent control that calls for the city to also lobby the state legislature to lift the ban on rent control. She's not getting any support so far from other city council members, and so she has posted a petition on the City Council Connection website asking residents of the city if you support a bill to push for rent control. It would not impose rent control in the city of Seattle. What it would do would be instruct the city council to enact rent control if and when the state legislature allows cities and municipalities in the state of Washington to do so. Currently, state law prevents it, and it would specify that the city council and the mayor's office lobby the state to remove its ban on rent control. That petition is at the Council Connection website at council.seattle.gov, if you'd like to go and sign that petition. Also, voting has begun for the projects that will get funding from the Neighborhood Street Fund. Smaller street repair projects are not always prioritized in the Seattle Department of Transportation budget. And the Neighborhood Street Fund is additional money set aside for these small repair and upgrade projects. Now, the city council and the city department of transportation have provided a website where you can go and vote on which projects you would like to have funded this year, this next 2-year budget cycle for your district. So you would need to know which city council district you live in, and you would need to go to the Neighborhood Street Fund website at www.seattle.gov/NSF for Neighborhood Street Fund and cast your vote. You can also read what all the different proposals are on that website. And you can also read about the process of selecting of projects and how they're submitted for Neighborhood Street Fund funds and the whole process of how they get added to that in case you have a project you would like to add.
Yeah, does beyond the city having you do this PSA for them, is there any effort by the city to let people know this is happening so that they could actually have voted on the different projects that directly impact them?
I learned about it from the Seattle City Council blog. That's where I learn a lot of what's going on mm-hmm. in the
and
city.
Did you do it on a home computer, or were you in the library using one of their computers?
I was on my home computer.
Okay.
But I believe it's important to vote on these kinds of things, too, because okay. some of these projects are really important, and the fact that they're not being funded automatically through the Transportation Department funding is kind of a shame. And this is a way that people can see, I wonder why these are not getting built automatically. And to prioritize, to help the city prioritize and say, these are important and we want you to do them.
Very good. All right. That looks like that wraps up.
that wraps up what the city council was working on this week. There were probably some other things.
They were working on some related stuff this week.
We're working on one more related thing. I mentioned Rob Johnson leaving his job on April 5th.
Skating over to the NHL gig.
Yes. The city council is wrapping up its process of selecting a replacement to represent District 4. That was Rob Johnson's district. Includes the University District, Wallingford, Roosevelt, Laurelhurst, Ravenna, and Sandpoint. 15 candidates applied. 2 dropped out, and 2 were eliminated because they don't live in District 4. Leaving 11.
Apparently they didn't know that.
They didn't know that, yeah. Leaving 11 candidates left. And the city council hasn't otherwise narrowed the field, so they are definitely still looking at all 11 candidates. They will be taking a final vote on Monday. The best of those candidates, I read through their bios. I read through their the letters that they sent in and their resumes and some of their references.
There's 2 videos up on Seattle Channel for the 2 hearings they've had so far. If people want to check that out.
Definitely you can check those out, and that would be a good thing to do. I was most impressed with Catherine Gardo, who sits on the Burke Gilman Public Development Authority Board and has served 2 terms on the board of PCC. She's also served as the executive director of PCC Farmland Trust and worked with Homestead Community Land Trust to preserve farmland in Puget Sound. And she's worked on affordable housing projects in South Seattle. But I was also favorably impressed with Jay Lazerwitz, an architect who is serving as the land use chair of the Roosevelt Neighborhood Association. He's a former member of the Seattle Light Rail Review Panel and former co-founder of ArtSpace Seattle, which focuses on providing affordable housing and workspaces for artists in the city of Seattle. Of course, the council may also consider some of the other candidates, Marjorie Press, who's an urban planner who has served on the Seattle Planning Commission since 2013 and has a transportation planning background. Abel Pacheco, who works in the Office of Minority Affairs and Diversity at the University of Washington and is very likely to represent the UW's interests, I think. And David Goldberg, who sits on the Seattle Planning Commission and is working for the Washington State Department of Transportation on the SR 520 project. The other candidates in this group lack experience in the public sector or have limited budget experience, or they have very old resumes, kind of stale resumes, and or they completely lack references. So those are the most serious candidates. I liked Catherine Gardow and Jay Lazerwitz. I think either one of them would make a good choice. And by making their decision on Monday, the city council will be appointing Johnson's replacement before the filing deadline for candidates to run for city council, which is May 17th. So it is very possible that whoever they select could then turn around and decide to run for the permanent District 4 seat later this year. So it's important that the city council get it right the first time.
All right.
And we'll see who they choose.
And as you had mentioned previously, there was another vote coming up on Monday. So they're
There are other things they're going to be discussing on Monday too. So the city council is going to have a very busy Monday ahead of them.
But and there's still time for people to get in there.
There is.
There's comments.
People can email comments, or you can call in comments.
Or just yell them from the back of the room.
I don't know that the city council will be taking comments on Monday because they have such a busy schedule that day. I think it would be best to send them in ahead of time.
All right. All right. Well, sticking with city council and future candidates,
yes.
replacements, the numbers
yeah.
continue to climb.
Yeah, they continue to climb. There are now 57 candidates running for city council. In a typical election year in the city of Seattle, you would have maybe 3, 4, or 5 at the most candidates running in a city council district race. This year, it's pretty much double that number. The biggest number is 12 people running for District 6 seat, which is being vacated by the hardworking Mike O'Brien in Northwest Seattle. 10 people are running in District 4, which is Rob Johnson's old seat. And there could be an 11th person, depending on who the city council picks and whether or not they decide they want to hold that seat for longer than a few months. There are 9 people currently running in District 7. That's Sally Bagshaw's district. That's the district I live in. Magnolia, Queen Anne, Belltown, and portions of downtown. There are 8 people running in District 3. That includes 7 challengers for Shama Sawant on Capitol Hill and in the Central District, although Beto Yarse, who was thought to be a strong contender in that race, has withdrawn his candidacy. There are 7 people running in District 2 for Bruce Harrell's seat that he is giving up in Southeast Seattle. There are 6 people running in District 6. That includes 5 challengers for Deborah Juarez and 5 in District 1, 4 challengers for Lisa Herbold, more like a normal city council race. So it's pretty wild right now, and it's going to be interesting to try to narrow down some of those candidates to see how many make the cut in terms of funding and stand out for the August 6th primary. Of course, we'll be looking at those candidates after the filing deadline closes, and we will give you our opinions on who we think the best candidates in those races are.
And there's still a month to go before
there is
for people to throw in their hats.
That's true.
So
there could be many more. We're
dusting off those hats as we speak. How much is it? Is the fee to join?
I don't know. if I were interested in running for the city council, I probably would know that off the top of my head.
Yep.
But I don't know. Let me just say, though, that it was interesting. Erica Barnett had a post in her blog, The C is for Crank, this week, saying that it's, what, about 15 candidates for city council are millionaires?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I would consider to be an unusually high number for an in-city race, but not if you're a big city. And Seattle is becoming a big, big city with big city-style politics. So it is worth looking at that and keeping track of that and thinking about whether we think that's a good trend or not to elect people, to have mostly millionaires running and to elect people who are worth more than $1 million. And I'm assuming, too, that their net worth, you know, some people have pointed out, well, you know, a lot of people own, you know, modest family homes that are worth $1 million or more now. But I'm assuming net worth is you own that house outright with no debt on it. And that's unusual for an American to have no debt on their home, no debt at all, and to be worth more than $1 million. Most people's net worth in the United States is well below that. And many people have negative net worth.
Mm. Well, and 15 of 57, so that's just short of a quarter of the people running. So apparently that's the new normal. And that would actually be low, I think, for if you compared it to Congress.
Oh, yeah, so. Definitely. Well, and those are races where it's easy for a millionaire to throw their hat in the ring and largely self-finance at least the beginnings of their race. So that's why that's why the issue of money in politics is so important.
All right. And just a side note, I also saw this week where Amazon had ponied up
$200,000 to give to the
Chamber of Commerce's
PAC to fund city council candidates. Now, they haven't committed to funding any city council candidates yet. They've said that they're going to wait. The Chamber of Commerce has said that they're going to wait until the filing deadline closes to see how it actually shakes out, who's in what race, in what districts before they start doling out the money. But, you know, this single $200,000 contribution from Amazon got a lot of news, but they've contributed fairly steadily to the Chamber of Commerce's PAC, and they've contributed to prior council races before and prior city races, they were a big supporter of Mayor Jenny Durkin's campaign. So they've been involved in Seattle politics for quite some time. This is not a first for them, although this is kind of a big, eye-catching one-time donation. I'm sure they'll probably have more money available for the future.
They've been steadily ramping up how much they pay into the city slush fund for elections. And it is an indicator, too, of what we can expect from some of the other large corporations that...
I would say Amazon's not alone. Yeah. In this. Now, the Chamber of Commerce, they took in that $200,000 donation from Amazon, but they'd already gotten something like $180,000 from other companies. So, you know, Amazon is definitely not alone. And they may be alone in the size of their donation, but they're not alone in giving to support the candidates of their choice.
And I would expect just Amazon alone to be contributing further just to this campaign, to these campaigns. So. I'm sure there'll be another record-setting year.
This, of course, is one way, too, that Amazon can get around campaign limits. Individuals and companies are limited to a certain amount that they can give to each candidate. I'm not exactly sure right now of what those amounts are. I don't remember them off the top of my head. But it's not very much that they can give to individual candidates out of their own pockets. But they can give unlimited amounts to these PACs. Like the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC. And that's one way that big corporations get around the campaign funding limits. And I think it's, you know, federal law allows it, but it would be awesome if the city would pass something that would say, no, maybe federal law allows it for federal campaigns, but we have a different criteria for city campaigns. I think that would be a very good direction for the city council to go.
All right, moving on. There was decisions being made in Olympia this week as well.
Yeah, a lot of bills are passing the state legislature. Several of them have passed both houses. This is the week, and Wednesday was the cutoff day for non-budget bills to have passed both houses at least once. Once a bill is passed both houses, there may be a final vote in a house. There may be a second vote in one of the houses if it got amended in the other house, and before it can go to the governor's desk. But once a bill is passed both houses, chances are really good that it's going to eventually go to the governor's desk for signature. And I just want to talk about some of the bills that have passed that hurdle this week. Senate Bill 5588. Authorizes public utility districts to generate hydrogen for fuel and clean energy purposes. That bill passed both houses unanimously and was signed into law by Governor Inslee this week. Currently, hydrogen cars are sold in California, which has hydrogen fueling stations available for drivers to use, but they're not sold much in Washington state. This legislation would open the door for the production of hydrogen fuel by Washington utilities, and it's a great first step towards starting up a hydrogen automobile market in Washington state. Once the fuel is available, fuel stations can be built, and then automobile manufacturers like Toyota, for example, could sell their hydrogen fuel cars here in the state of Washington. Hydrogen fuel is produced by splitting water into oxygen and hydrogen atoms, and the only emissions produced by hydrogen fuel cars are water droplets. Another clean energy bill, Senate Bill 5116, passed the House this week, so it has passed both houses now. This bill would require public utilities to generate 100% carbon neutral energy by the year 2030 and would move Washington state to 100% carbon-free electricity generation by the year 2045. Those are pretty modest goals, and I think the dates should be more like 2021 and 2025. But this is more than any other state in the United States has done so far. The bill now moves back to the Senate for a vote on amendments that were added in the House. If it passes its second vote in the Senate, it'll head directly to Governor Inslee's desk for his signature. And we can definitely expect that Inslee will pick that bill up, wave it around, make a big to-do about it as right before he signs it.
Yeah, and he'll fly off to the East Coast
to do his presidential campaign. Yeah. There are two more conservation bills that Inslee has really pushed to get passed and that have passed both houses. House Bill 1257 passed in the Senate by a narrow 25 to 23 vote. That bill gives the Commerce Department the ability to write new energy standards for buildings larger than 50,000 square feet. That would address the second, help to address the second largest emitter of carbon pollution in our state, which is older buildings and their lack of energy conservation, and the fact that the state building codes can be upgraded to require older buildings to come up to code in order to become more energy efficient. That's that bill could very well end up on Governor Inslee's desk. Also, House Bill 1444 would set efficiency standards for some appliances that use electricity or water. Now, proponents of the bill say that that would save consumers more than $2 billion in utility payments by the year 2035. It could also help to reduce the use of energy overall in the state of Washington and help with our carbon emissions. So those two bills could end up on Governor Inslee's desk, and he would probably wave those around before he signs them and make a big to-do and say, ha-ha, I am the conservation governor. You should elect me for president. Now, another bill that has passed both houses and is on the governor's desk for a signature is House Bill 1219, which authorizes cities and counties to spend money collected from the real estate excise tax on both services for the homeless and on affordable housing projects. That's a very good bill, and that is headed for Governor Inslee's signature. Senate Bill 5497 is a bill to protect immigrants in Washington state. It's passed both houses and may soon be headed to the governor's desk as well. That bill would require state agencies to provide services to people without considering their citizenship status. And it would limit the exchange of information and immigration activities between our state government and the federal government. That's to protect people who may be targeted by ICE, Border Patrol, et cetera.
So departments like the Department of Licensing, where
yes,
they gave information to the feds on different applicants that would legally stop them.
Yes.
Or at least have a penalty if they do it.
Yes. And the bill specifies in the provision of services to immigrants in Washington state that the state put in place a secure means by which they collect information, which means that that information would not then be leaked to outside sources, not to the federal government and federal agencies. So that would be a very good bill to end up on the end up on the governor's desk. And finally, four bills that would help our southern resident whale population in Washington state passed both houses this week and also may soon be headed for Inslee's signature. Senate Bill 5135 controls the release of toxins in state waterways. House Bill 1579 would protect shorelines and help restore salmon habitat. House Bill 1578 requires smaller oil tankers to be escorted by tugs in Rosario Strait. That's the strait that that connects the Strait of Juan de Fuca with the Georgia Strait, just west of the San Juan Islands. That's the same as the requirement for large oil tankers that they currently have right now. Senate Bill 5577 sets new regulations for the whale watching industry, including limiting the number of boats and increasing the distance between boats and whales to 400 yards, which is double the federal limit, which is the current limit right now in Washington state. The bill to temporarily halt whale watching, however, has not been introduced in either house this year. That was a key recommendation by the governor's panel on how to save orcas in Puget Sound. That bill was considered political dynamite by members of both parties, and so it did not go anywhere.
Yeah, I didn't see a lot of support from that bill coming from the whale experts locally either. But noticeable here is that there's like nothing to coming up about the removing the four lower Snake River dams,
yes,
which would
there was
supply
a,
food.
Yes, there is another bill that would set up a panel to study the removal of the four lower Snake River dams. And that bill has not gone very far through the legislature either, unfortunately, even though a lot of whale experts, a lot of orca experts in Western Washington have said that restoring salmon runs to the Columbia River and the Snake River is vitally important for saving the southern resident whale population.
The existing, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they might as well be convening a panel on how they'll dispose of the southern resident orcas when they die here in the next few years. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, we're at the
About halfway through the show, and I just want to say that if you enjoy listening to the show, if it's a key part of your week, then please give us a call. And or
operators standing by.
No, please
that's weird.
Go.
No one's answering.
Please go to our website at kodxseattle.org and click on the button to donate to KODX and
it's
become
in
a
the upper right corner.
Yes. We have a Patreon button. It allows you to become a regular sponsor and donate a monthly contribution. Or you can write a check. A lot of folks prefer to not go online, and they'd rather take out their checkbook and send us a check. Make it out a check to Earth on the Air, Independent Media. And you can mail that check to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And we'll repeat that address at the end of the broadcast.
Yeah. And big thanks to everybody that has done so in the past, and everybody that's become a Patreon member. It
really helps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Both methods are allowing us to continue broadcasting.
Yeah.
So on to national and the big news this week.
And the big news this week was the Mueller report. I read through the synopsis. I read through the introductions and the executive summary of both volumes. Yes, there are two volumes. The first volume looks at whether or not the Trump campaign coordinated with Russian intelligence to try to get Donald Trump elected. Volume two looks at whether Donald Trump committed any obstruction of justice. They separated that out into its own volume and its own investigation because there was actually so much evidence of it. There was really not much there that I could tell in the report. I didn't read through the entire report and haven't had the time yet, but I will eventually read much of it. There doesn't look like there's a whole lot there that's new, and that if there is, it was probably blacked out by Attorney General William Barr after he consulted with Donald Trump's lawyers in the White House. There are full pages that are blacked out. There are half pages that are blacked out, and there are many paragraphs that are half blacked out. So there is quite a significant portion of the document that we can't read. And that's important because the whole idea behind the Mueller report is that there be an investigation and make very clear and very public whether or not there was conspiracy to manipulate the 2016 elections and whether or not the president was involved in illegal activity to obstruct the investigation. Now, Attorney General William P. Barr, the other takeaway that I got from this report too, is that Attorney General William P. Barr lied when he said that Mueller found no obstruction of justice. The report itself very clearly says, and this is a direct quote, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment. The evidence we obtained about the president's actions and intent presents difficult issues that prevent us from conclusively determining that no criminal conduct occurred. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him." That says, and that's the end of the quote, that says point blank to me that Trump is not innocent here, that they have the evidence that he did commit a crime. And just a couple of paragraphs before this statement, the report says, and this is another direct quote, "We determined not to apply an approach that would potentially result in a judgment that the president committed crimes." And there's more information in there. And it goes on to say why they chose not to make a judgment that the president committed a crime. They say, and this is another direct quote, "Fairness concerns counseled against potentially reaching that judgment when no charges can be brought," end quote, which means that the Mueller team made a decision that or realized that they would not be able to bring charges against a sitting president. The Department of Justice has a rule in place that they felt prevented them from being able to bring charges against President Trump. And so then that stopped them from being able to say definitively, we think he's guilty. That's what that wording means. But it's very clear in the evidence that they lay out that they think he's guilty. I don't think there's any question there about that at all. And furthermore, what I think is kind of interesting is that there are other legal experts who don't agree with that judgment made by the Mueller team. They don't think that it was beyond the capability of the Mueller team to bring charges against the president, or they think that it was not beyond the Mueller's team ability to say that even though they couldn't bring charges, that he is guilty of a crime. So there's some disagreement there, perhaps even among members of the team. But of course, Robert Mueller would have had the overall say as to how things were worded in the conclusions of this report, and he definitely believes this. And that's why he did not come out and say that Trump is guilty, although the way the report is laid out and the other wording in the executive summary really points to the fact that they think he is guilty. Now, Barr, Attorney General William P. Barr, by issuing a summation that says exactly the opposite of that, that Trump is innocent, essentially gave up on doing his job to enforce the law of the United States under the Constitution, really. Instead, he tried to protect the president. That was what he saw as his chief duty, not the chief duties specified under the Constitution for the attorney general. And of course, that's what Donald Trump hired him to do. But I think that that means Barr is unfit to do his job. And I think Congress should be looking at removing him from his job as soon as possible, whether or not they decide to impeach Trump. I think really they should say there's no way that William P. Barr should be allowed to continue his job when he just lied about the Mueller report and he just refused to enforce the laws of the United States. Now, there was one piece of new information in the Mueller report that I found very interesting. Trump personally and clearly asked his staff multiple times to get their hands on Hillary Clinton's emails from her home server. Now, he didn't just say once. Now, he says he said once in joking, wouldn't it be great if Russian hackers or WikiLeaks had Hillary's missing emails, right? Well, he didn't just say that once publicly as a joke. He said multiple times, seriously, to his staff, let's get our hands on those emails. He gave the okay for his staff members to work with hackers and with foreign government intelligence services, including Russia's, to try to get their hands on those emails so they could be used to manipulate the election. Now, this is clearly illegal. It's clearly illegal. It's corrupt and it's treasonous activity. And it doesn't matter that it wasn't successful. The intent was there to do these, and not just the intent, but the actual attempt to, and it was still undertaken. And that, in my mind, is grounds for impeachment, regardless of everything else in the report. And there is other criminal activity highlighted in both volumes of the report. So far, the Democratic leadership in the House has resisted calls to impeach Trump. Their position is to subpoena the full unredacted Mueller report from the Attorney General's office and continue digging for more dirt. They hope that this will help them unseat Trump in the 2020 elections and turn the Senate over to a Democratic majority. Of course, in the meantime, corruption and incompetence in the Trump administration is doing a lot of damage to the federal government, to the environment of the United States, to the states, and to municipal government, and to the U.S.'s reputation abroad, and not to mention damage to the planet as a whole since Donald Trump has removed us from the Paris Climate Accords. So I think the Democratic leadership in Congress really bear some serious questioning, and people should be contacting those folks who make the decisions in the House of Representatives, in the Democratic leadership, and asking them, why the heck aren't you doing your job? This man has committed crimes and he needs to be removed from office. Whether or not the Senate agrees.
Wasn't the primary reason for redactions, I believe it, over 60% of the redactions were because that information is part of other ongoing investigations?
Yeah, a large number of them, apparently. But it's hard to know because we only know about the investigations and the charges that have already become public. Apparently, there are many more investigations still ongoing that have not become public. So there's a lot there. Democrats in the House should also be requesting evidence, not just the unredacted report, but the evidence behind it. Some of the testimony and some of the other evidence that supports these charges could illuminate a whole lot and could include stuff that is not in the report that is very, very important for the public to know.
And then also this week on Tom Hartman, which we air his shows during the weekdays, 10 a.m. here on KODX, he had pointed out that it was repeated multiple times in the report that Mueller had stated, if we had had more time, mm-hmm. We could have potentially pursued this or that.
Not just time, but also he mentions in the report, too, and this is only in the executive summary. I'm sure it's probably elsewhere in the report as well. He also mentions, too, that a number of people, even after saying that they were going to cooperate, Michael Flynn and Michael Cohen, even though they were saying that, yes, we will cooperate with the Mueller team's investigation, lied and withheld information. There were a lot of messages that were encrypted and could not be unencrypted. There were a lot of messages that were destroyed, a lot of paperwork that was destroyed. And so it makes clear, even in the executive summary, that there was a lot of evidence that was out of reach and that the Mueller team couldn't get their hands on. And if these witnesses had been fully forthcoming and if that evidence had not been destroyed, which is the legal definition of obstruction of justice, is destroying evidence, right? If they could have gotten their hands on that evidence, that they could have had a more thorough investigation, and they may have uncovered a lot more criminal wrongdoing than what they did. So that's very clear from the report as well.
So a lot of this is going to be determined by the current Democrats in office, and mm-hmm. then the public, what the public
and
chooses to do.
Yeah, and what the public chooses to do. And it is well within your right as a citizen of the United States or as a resident of the United States, if you don't have full citizenship yet, to really ask, what are you doing, Congress? Get your hands on this stuff. Pursue the legal remedies that you have to hold the president accountable for his actions. And it's clear it's not just it wasn't just the Trump campaign sitting back and letting this stuff happen. They really were active in engaging with Russian intelligence to try to disrupt and try to corrupt a presidential election.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. Well, William Barr was doing other things this week as well.
Oh, yes. In one of his first decisions in terms of immigration this week, William Barr, he has rescinded bail hearings and bail for asylum seekers, for immigration asylum seekers in the United States. Now, bail hearings are a fundamental element of our criminal justice system. People who come to the United States or a port of entry also have a right to request asylum and then legally enter our legal justice system and get things like bail hearings and asylum hearings. This week, Attorney General William Barr announced that asylum seekers would no longer be allowed bail in our criminal justice system. By doing this, he unilaterally reversed a 2005 Board of Immigration Appeals Court decision that granted the right to bail hearings to all asylum seekers. Barr said that the court decision was, quote unquote, wrongly decided, using a term that Donald Trump has used often to criticize the courts. Barr said his decision will not take effect for 90 days so that the Department of Homeland Security can set up more tent shelters, in other words, concentration camps, to hold immigrants in Texas. The American Civil Liberties Union vowed to immediately challenge Barr's decision in court. This comes after news leaked that the Trump administration had sought to dump large numbers of immigrants in sanctuary cities like Seattle, San Francisco, and New York. Sanctuary cities are local and municipal governments that have vowed not to cooperate with federal immigration actions in their communities. This week, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin won national press by writing a letter in response to the Trump administration saying that we're not afraid of immigrants in Seattle. In fact, King County, which is where the city of Seattle is, has one of the largest immigrant populations in America, with 500,000 immigrants here, making up almost half of the county's population growth in the past decade. And we have one of the fastest growing economies, if not the fastest growing economy in the United States right now. So yes, we will take them.
All right. And in parallel to that, the Trump administration is expanding their camps.
Yes, expanding their camps to try to hold as many immigrants in detention as possible. This is after they have dumped large numbers of immigrants in cities in southern Texas and along the border, because guess what? Immigration facilities are completely overcrowded. The Trump administration claims that there are huge numbers of immigrants flowing across the border, but it is nowhere near the record numbers that came across the border in the 80s and 90s. The problem is that the Trump administration has created a crisis by not giving people their initial hearing and then allowing them to be released and going into communities to get jobs and to become normalized residents of the United States. Instead, they've decided to detain as many immigrants as possible. And of course, that has created massive overcrowding in immigration detention facilities, in local jails that have been conscripted to hold immigrants, in temporary shelters that do not meet public health standards and safety standards. And so now they're looking for whatever means possible they can to build more space to hold more immigrants. And to do that, they're setting up these tent cities now. And I just want to point out, too, here in the city of Seattle, we've come under criticism for allowing homeless people to live in tent cities. And we've been told by quote-unquote experts that that's no way to house the homeless. You know, that it's a violation of their rights, that it's not up to public health and safety standards. And yet here's the federal government saying, well, you know, we're going to do that for immigrants coming into the United States. We're going to put them in tent encampments.
And a bunch of these are private.
Oh,
where
yeah.
Where they're charging $800 a day per person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole federal detention system, that's a whole nother topic. But the whole federal detention system is essentially the government paying private companies to warehouse people, usually in substandard conditions. And this is no different from that.
So private companies with very little oversight.
And profiting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Big profits. Which then cycle back to the very people that are calling the shots on this. So, all right. Moving on further cheerful news, climate change.
Yeah, a couple of interesting things I want to talk about the impacts of the our changing climate. Folks may remember a recent report that 25 states in the U.S. are expected to see record flooding this spring, even after Midwest states like Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and South Dakota already set records for flood levels in March. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has warned that nearly two-thirds of the lower 48 states are at risk of flooding through May. This is an expected outcome of global warming. I want to point out, warmer air in the atmosphere holds more moisture, which then falls either as snow when it's cold, which is we saw this last winter with record snows throughout the Midwest and the East Coast, or as rain when it's not cold, which we're starting to see now. In March, what happened was record amounts of rain fell on top of record amounts of snow. The ground was still frozen, so the ground could not absorb that moisture, and it flowed into rivers. Rivers overflowed, and we had record flooding throughout the Mississippi River Basin. Now, the NOAA is saying that much of the U.S. east of the Mississippi River is expected to see some flooding, which could impact more than 200 million people. That's over 60% of the nation's population could be impacted by flooding this year, this spring alone. Now, in the meantime, as the central United States grows wetter, some parts of the world are growing drier. This week, the New York Times ran a story entitled Central American Farmers Head to the U.S. Fleeing Climate Change. I recommend everybody read that article if you can get your hands on it. It describes the increasing number of farmers in Honduras whose farms are failing because of a changing climate and who are leaving home to emigrate to the U.S. as a result. In Central America, a large percentage of the population are small farmers who grow food and grow coffee for export. When their crops fail, there isn't any financial support system to keep them from starving or from losing their land. They don't have crop insurance like farmers in the United States do, particularly big corporate farms do. And while the U.S. is quick to throw money at anti-drug and anti-terrorism programs in Latin America, our government provides very little help to subsistence farmers in Latin American countries. Donald Trump has even threatened to cut all aid to Central America because of the influx of immigrants to our southern border, which of course would only make things worse by cutting the few programs that do help to fund people who are at the brink of starvation or at the brink of losing their land in countries in Latin America. So Donald Trump, once again, proving that not only is he corrupt, he's also incompetent, does not understand the problem, and does not understand that the actions he's taking are making the problem worse.
Yeah, I think we were actually talking about that a few weeks ago, where he had designated Guatemala, Honduras,
and El Salvador, I think,
as the Northern Triangle.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they would no longer be receiving aid through the State Department.
As if immigration is on a par with drug trafficking and weapons trafficking, et cetera. It is not, and there is no conspiracy to embarrass him by these Latin American countries trying to send their populations northward. That's the weirdest kind of mental illness I can think of is thinking that these countries are conspiring to send their hordes north to invade your country. We can talk a lot about Donald Trump's mental issues, but I think more than anything, allowing him to remain in office is really doing a lot of damage to our nation right now.
And to our own mental health.
Certainly.
All right. Moving on to that kind of was international to a degree, but...
To more international news.
More. It had a historic vote that got vetoed.
Yeah, this week on Tuesday, Donald Trump vetoed that historic resolution that was passed by Congress to invoke the War Powers Act to end U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's aerial bombing campaign in Yemen. Trump showed his allegiance to a foreign dictator by choosing to support Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Bin Salman is the main supporter of the war inside the Saudi Arabian government. And it is widely thought that he's also responsible for the assassination of the former Washington Post reporter and Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi. The bombing campaign that Saudi Arabia is undertaking in Yemen has created the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with 10 million people now at risk for starvation this year. As many as 100 civilians per week die from the fighting in Yemen. The U.S. provides fuel, planes, weapons, and other equipment, including diplomatic cover for the Saudi military and the Saudi government in pursuing this bombing campaign. Now, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump bragged multiple times about the tens of millions of dollars he has personally made from doing business with rich Saudi customers, including the government of Saudi Arabia, since at least the early 1990s. So I think in this case, he is listening to his pocketbook more than he is listening to his advisors or even listening to people who know anything about the conflict in Yemen. Also this week, he decided, and I just read this morning, that he would support the Libyan General Khalifa Haftar, who is trying to take over the UN-supported Libyan coalition government. Haftar controls a small portion of the country in eastern Libya. The bulk of the population in Libya lives in the western part of the country, and the bulk of the population supports the democratically elected UN-supported coalition government. The fact that our president loves a general who would try to overthrow that democratically elected government is just one more strike against Donald Trump, and should be very seriously considered by the Democrats when they're weighing the political calculus of whether or not to pursue an impeachment hearing.
But it is consistent with the other world leaders who he likes to gravitate to.
He loves dictators. He loves dictators. Even one like Hifter, who it appears to me couldn't possibly succeed in taking over the entirety of the Libyan, of the nation of Libya, but is willing to still engage in fighting and killings anyway.
All right. Well, we don't have much time left if we're going to squeeze in some events. There were some protests this week.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the climate protests in London. The movement Extinction Rebellion had declared this week a week of civil disobedience for the planet. Starting on Monday, demonstrators blocked major intersections and tourist sites throughout London, including Parliament Square, Marble Arch, Oxford Circus, Waterloo Bridge, Canary Wharf, and Piccadilly Circus. Activists hung banners, carried signs, chained themselves to trucks, glued themselves to the pavement, and pitched tents in the middle of intersections to push for action on climate change. While some of the intersections had been cleared by Friday, Waterloo Bridge had remained continuously occupied for 5 days straight, in spite of over 570 arrests. The protesters have three demands: one, that the UK government declare a climate and ecological emergency; two, that the government agree to reduce the UK's greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by the year 2025. I should point out, a much more ambitious goal than the state of Washington just passed into law. 2025 should be the goal. And their third demand is that the UK government set up a citizens' assembly, which would take the lead in making decisions on how best to prevent a climate disaster. Protests were scheduled in 80 cities in 33 countries, including France, Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, New Zealand, Japan, Australia, and the United States, where protesters staged a sit-in in front of the Republican National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C. Here in the city of Seattle, protesters did a die-in at the federal building on Tax Day, April 15th. And there are more demonstrations and more activities expected in the coming days. Extinction Rebellion has sprung out of Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg's Fridays for Future youth climate protests, wherein she has urged other teenagers to walk out of school on Fridays to disrupt business as usual, to demand that adults take responsibility and save the planet for future generations.
And if the adults don't take responsibility, then the youth are going to grab the wheel.
Yes.
So hand it over. we just got to squeeze in
our events.
Events which are generally climate related.
Yeah, well, Monday is Earth Day, April 22nd. Just want to mention that. On Tuesday, Central District Tenants' Right Boot Camp is hosted by the B Seattle and City Council member Shama Sawant. Learn your rights as a tenant and get your questions answered. That's at Squirrel Chops, 2201 East Union Street, from 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday is Resist Trump Tuesday, hosted by Seattle Indivisible. This week's speaker is Hannah Hartman of Planned Parenthood. The rally is from 11:45 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Federal Building at 2nd and Marion downtown. Bring your pro-choice signs. On Wednesday, the UW Center for Human Rights is hosting a panel on their new report, Hidden in Plain Sight, ICE Air and Machinery, which unveils the secret deportation flights out of Boeing Field and some of the human rights abuses that occur on those flights. That's at Thompson Hall, room 101 on the UW campus on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. On Thursday, three events. Extinction Rebellion Seattle is hosting a public forum confronting the extinction crisis with journalists Dar Jamail and Curtis Deutsch, associate professor of oceanography at the UW. That's at Kane Hall on the UW campus from 7:30 to 9:30. Also on Thursday, it's time for a Green New Deal. That's a town hall conversation about local solutions to climate change with State Senator Jessen Farrell and District 4 City Council candidate Sean Scott. That's at University Heights Community Center at 50th and University Way from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Mike, what's the other Thursday event?
And also, as if there wasn't enough on Thursday on that, at 6 p.m. at the University of Washington Hub, room 250, a panel entitled Envisioning a Green New Deal in Washington State. It's a panel made up of many people, Liania Alala, Debelina Banagiri, Dr. Neves Dulsack, and Councilmember Mike O'Brien. And so that's
also worth checking out. You could start there at 6 p.m. and make the rounds.
You could find out which one has the best snacks.
Yeah. Now, also on Friday, Elliott Bay Book Company hosts author Aaron Bobrow Strain and Montserrat Padilla of the Washington Immigration Solidarity Network to talk about immigrants facing detention centers and militarization at the border. That's 7 p.m. at Elliott Bay Book Company at 1521 10th Avenue on Capitol Hill. And then on Saturday is the fifth anniversary celebration and fundraiser for La Resistencia and its work with undocumented immigrants at the Northwest Detention Center. That looks like it's going to be a great party and fundraiser. The party is from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southside Commons at 3518 South Edmund Street. There will be live music, DJ Mike Ramos from KEXP, a cake auction, and a cash bar. Tickets are $25 at the door. And Saturday is Independent Bookstore Day. Visit your local independent bookstore for quality reading material.
But wait, there's more. There's also today free baseball at T-Mobile Park this tonight at 6:30 p.m. You can watch Ballard High School take on West Seattle. And I just thought that, you know, it's a nice day. It's like, how often
it's
can
free.
You get into T-Mobile Park for free and to watch real athletes that actually would really appreciate having you show
having
up and,
a,
and
having
cheer them on.
A good, big audience.
An honest, good old baseball game. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
And weather's supposed to be good today, too. So
wasn't it good when you got here? It was great when I came in this morning. Uh-huh. All right. So we will then plan on seeing you next week.
And I want to thank everyone who has donated to support KODX. If you would like to make a donation, go to our website at kodxseattle.org and click on the Patreon button, or send us a check made out to Earth on the Air Independent Media to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. Thank you.